So there were a couple of questions yesterday that I didn't have time to answer at the end of the talk, and I don't know if the people who asked them are still here. It doesn't look like, but there was a question about the mismatch between the spoken language and the text that you would get in the lecture notes for this MIT data. And this slide is showing that. So you can see in the blue box here, we have the transcription of the speech. And in the yellow box is the relevant paragraph in the lecture notes, right? And you can see how they're very different. You have the words, you have matrix, you have multiplication, element, maybe. Element is probably in the vocabulary anyway. But then you see how Gilbert, the instructor, says it. He says, well, I've been talking, I've been multiplying matrices already, but certainly time for me to discuss the rules for matrix multiplication, right? I mean, it's not even proper English. But certainly time for me, it should be, but it's certainly time for me. And it's pretty hard to read. Some people who transcribe this bothered to actually put in the punctuation, the capitalization information, sentence boundaries. So that makes it a little easier to read. But still, you can see how it's very, very different. And using the text in the yellow box to help us build a language model for the type of stuff that is in the blue box is going to have a limited impact. Maybe in terms of reducing the auto vocabulary rate, but that's about where it stops. So that was one point. And then I think you asked me yesterday about how people deal with homophones or homographs. So I added a slide here to answer your question. And normally when you build a lexicon, you start with pronunciations that are created by hand. Dictionaries have something along those lines already. You will also need, however, some algorithm that is going to help you create pronunciations for words that are not in vocabulary. And so you need these two things, both of them. As far as encoding in the FST world for the lexicon, so I have here three entries. And the first one is the verb read, to read, right, in the infinitive form. And the pronunciation for it is, as you see it on the right, it's read. And I made up the phonetic alphabet. It may not be correct, but you can see how the first read and the second read, that's the past tense of the same verb, it's exactly the same lexical entry. You know, the word doesn't change, but the pronunciation is different. And then to add to this, I have the word red, the color red, which has exactly the same pronunciation as the past tense of read. And because of this, the lexicon is not a deterministic finite state machine. You will have uncertainty at some point as you traverse an input string. If, for example, the transduction happens from words to sequences of phones, and I hit the word red, well, I will have two possibilities there. And I need to explore both of them when I do the search for what has actually been said there. And similarly, when I traverse the sequence of phones R, A, D, I will need to have two branches, one that is for the word red, the color red, and one for the other one, which is the past tense of the word read. So it's not, I told you yesterday that it's not a deterministic machine. So that's what a non-deterministic machine means. It means that for a given input, there might be more than one path in your machine that will accept that input. Does that make sense to you? Yeah. Okay. So those were the questions yesterday. And now This is where we left it. So just to sort of refresh your memory, I said that a good way to encode the output of a speech recognizer, or in fact, this is actually the search space of the speech recognizer, is a lattice, and it's nothing but a more compact representation for a long list of word hypotheses for a given utterance A, right? So we prune, you could list all the possible word sequences, but that would be way too many, and the vast, vast majority of them have very small probabilities. So we're only going to keep the ones that are likely for this utterance. And when I say likely, I mean that we're going to use the probability models that we built, the acoustic model and the language model, to evaluate the joint probability of the word sequence and the acoustics, and then hopefully list the top some thousand number hypotheses here. And then we make the representation more compact such that we can save space. And in a lattice like this, we have nodes. It's a directed acyclic graph. So we have a start node and an end node. And links, you don't go back. You always go from left to right. You don't have cycles. Since you can't go back, you can't just keep going in a loop, right? That means that it's an acyclic graph. So if you were to start walking on links in the lattice, you would always move from left to right. And before some finite number of steps, you will hit the end of the lattice, right? Each link in the lattice represents a word occurrence. And it's not just a word as a symbol. It has attached to it the start time where our models think that word happened in that utterance, the end time, and those are nodes. And then on the link, we also store the language model probability, which is P of W for that word in the context in which it happens, to the left. We use n-gram models. And then we also store the acoustic model score, which is the probability of all the feature vectors between the start time and the end time for that link, given that word, right? So that's the information being stored in the lattice. If I want to just output one hypothesis, which is what a recognizer normally does, I will try to find out the highest scoring path in this lattice. And if I just had them listed, I could very easily sort this list by the probability and output that as the top hypothesis. And we don't store them like that. We have this lattice, so it's not immediately obvious how you would get the top scoring hypothesis. How many people here have heard of dynamic programming and Viterbi algorithm? Right. So this is a pretty important algorithm, and it deals with exactly such situations where you, I don't think I can do a very good job at explaining it in a few words, but you would want to know, if you want to know what is the best way of getting from the start node to the end node in a graph, you can break the problem recursively and say, well, what is the best way of getting from this node, from the start node, up to some arbitrary node in the graph, right? Assume that we know how to solve that problem, right? So then, if I know how to solve that problem, I can do the following recursive extension. I can say, well, if I know the best way to get to each of the nodes, so each of the nodes that lead into some other node, right? So in this case, I know the best way to get here, and I know the best way to get here, then I can easily calculate the best way to get here. And I don't need to look any further. All I need to look at is the incoming links into the node that I'm interested in. So what I have to do is I take the best path coming into here, I add the score or multiply the score depending on which Semmering I work in, and I calculate the score to get to this node according to this link, the best score according to this other link, and I keep only the maximum, right? So what this does is it does a very efficient computation for the best scoring path in a graph like this. And the technique is part of a more general set of algorithms called dynamic programming. And when you're searching for the max like this, I think that's when it's called the Viterbi algorithm, if I remember right. But this is something good to know, I think, in general. You're going to bump into this over and over whenever you start dealing with sequences and sequence labeling problems and so on. That's what you can use to retrieve the highest scoring path in this lattice. And the complexity of the algorithm, if I remember right, is linear in the number of nodes in the lattice. You have to look at every single node, and linear in the number of links as well. Or maybe squared. I forget. So anyhow, I'm sure you find it in Wikipedia. If you go and do a web search on dynamic programming, Viterbi, Wikipedia, you're going to find a very nice explanation there. So prefer that over what I said. So now a few issues in speech. Now that you know we have a basic understanding for how one would go about building a speech recognizer, what are the problems? Well, probably the biggest problem as far as language modeling is concerned is that you take language modeling training data that is expected to be similar to the test data. And that is not well quantified. I mean, similar means, it's like it. And as a human, you can say, yeah, well, you know, broadcast news text is similar to Wall Street Journal text, and less similar to this type of stuff. But how exactly do you do that computation and why is hard to tell. So there's a lot of art in building good language models. And most of it has to deal with selecting your training data. What is that you're going to use to train your models with? And once you have that, you just turn the crank. It's, you know, you extract n-grams, you use some smoothing technique, and you're pretty much done. And there are toolkits out there on the web. You can use, there's something from CMU, there's a language modeling toolkit. There's one from SRI, Andreas Stolke. Just search for language modeling toolkit and you're gonna get a few pointers very quickly. And they're freely available. You can build language models very easily. The key issue is really, what is the training data that you're using? What is the vocabulary? As soon as, let's say, I take a language model built on broadcast news and I use it on MIT lectures, things don't match anymore. The n-grams are not the same. The vocabulary is slightly mismatched. I will have out-of-vocabulary words. If you, you know, happen to work at Google or you somehow have a lot of text data and you're able to process it, you're going to start asking yourself, well, so what if I have tera words of data? Literally, we have tera words of data. If I'm unable to pick which data I should use to build my language model with, sure, you can just build a language model from all that data and say, well, that's what I'm going to use, but that doesn't sound like the right thing to do. So I think this is a big, big problem, and I haven't seen a good solution to this yet. Language model adaptation is simply, at this point, concerned with, you know, somebody gives me a small amount of data that is very much like my test data, but it's not enough to build a language model, maybe 40,000 words or 100,000 words, and then I have tera words sitting somewhere on disk, and I want to find data just like my adaptation data. And it's hard to explain what exactly just like my adaptation data means and how exactly I go and pull out that data from that large repository of text to build my language model in an optimal way. And the questions to be answered here is, you know, what is a good vocabulary for the test data? Do I need new n-grams, and which are they that I need to pull out of the big corpus? What if I already have n-gram probabilities in my language model that I've built from a background corpus? How can I adjust it? How can I adjust those probabilities to match the adaptation data? So this is a good research problem. And now I'm going to go over a few issues in acoustic modeling again, with adaptation in mind. There's a lot of variability. You immediately hear it. Accents, speech, speed. People speak faster or slower depending on, you know, that's how they speak, or sometimes the same person can speak faster or slower. There's variability in the channel. If you speak over the phone, you're going to have different type of distortions than, you know, what we have here in this room. Here you have echoes from the walls. It's just a very different acoustic environment. So all these issues, there's prosody. If you want to say, you know, something, you convey information by how you modulate your speech. So it all adds up to a slightly bigger amount of variability that our models can handle these days. And if you go and build a speaker-independent model, namely you ignore all this and you just say, oh, well, you know, all the data is more or less speech that's saying the same thing, you get, for example, for two vowels here, you would get a contour like this in some feature space. And then if you separate and look at one speaker, you would get something slightly different. If you look at another speaker, you would get something that looks almost like it, but not quite there. And, you know, the blue circles would be somehow the average of all these other circles that you get. And you would ideally want to build a tight model that is targeted at one of these speakers, because that's what you need to recognize. And to show that there is value in that, I'm going to skip the slide because I don't know if it makes a lot of sense since you guys are not directly interested in this. This is a very successful acoustic model adaptation technique, and all it does is to apply a linear transformation to the means of the acoustic model Gaussians. And the key idea is that the transformation matrix R is tied across models, and you estimate it on a speaker-dependent fashion. So the way adaptation goes is you take your audio, you run it through the recognizer, and using speaker-independent models, so you get your first pass result. So now you have a guess at what has been said. And then you take that transcription and go back to adapt your models. So now your models know exactly what words and phones were there, and you just want to match that particular utterance or set of utterances as well as you can. So you change your models, and one way to change it was doing that linear transformation. But you basically end up building a new recognizer. And this new recognizer has a different acoustic model which has been matched to this particular utterance. And then you run that and you get a final result. And you can actually iterate this. And this is actually very powerful. If you know, the key here is to know what is you know, data that, again, comes from a given speaker, because that's what you want to use to do your adaptation. The more data that you're confident that, you know, is similar to the data that you're going to need to decode, the better you are. And here is a table. This is our results from MIT. TJ allowed me to use these results in the presentation. If you just use a baseline speaker-independent recognizer, you have about 47% word error rate on. I don't know exactly which of the lectures. So. By doing some language model adaptation using the lecture notes and so on, you get some improvement, not a whole lot. But you can see how big the gains are from doing acoustic model adaptation. You can almost, I think that's about 60% relative, if you can do it well.
I see here that the length modeling is going to the word error rate.
Right.
That, if you take a good acoustic model, a good length model, and add a variance domain, that probably gives out the amount of gain in production.
What do you mean by? So are you saying, is this an upper bound for language modeling adaptation performance, or?
Generally speaking, what sort of improvement do you get from language modeling on top of the acoustic modeling? Because it seems rather small in this example.
I don't know. It depends on, you know, the problem that you're looking at. Where was the mismatch? Where was it bigger? It seems that here there was a huge mismatch in terms of acoustic modeling. The language model is mismatched, but it's unclear whether you can get much more if you had a better language model, because we don't really have that language model. So that's why the language modeling adaptation is a big issue. You don't even have an upper bound. You know that you should be doing a little better, but you don't know how much better you could do. So if it was so clear that there's a lot of gains to be had, you would see a lot more work in that space. But people try a few things, they realize that it's very hard, and they don't even have a good idea about, you know, how much is there to be gained. So it's sort of there. So, but these are typical figures. This used a lot of acoustic modeling for doing the adaptation. He used about 38 previous lectures, which is a lot. People don't usually have that much adaptation data, and he knew exactly how to adapt it. The other thing about the MIT lectures is that you have a lot of data coming from a given speaker. It's one guy who teaches one class. Okay, so then you start having, we're talking tens of hours of speech. Normally, you don't get that much adaptation data. But it does give you a dimension for how important the problem is. I mean, when you see such reductions in word error rate, it's very nice. Okay.
Can you tell us how the auto vocabulary word rates changed after adding the data to a language model?
Well, there was a slide. These are experiments, this is work he did at MIT. And I don't fully know exactly what he did. We can talk afterwards. I can show you the slides that I have from him. And there is something there on language modeling. You can also find the papers. I think that's published work already. If you search for Hazen and this type of stuff. But I have some slides for you. Just remind me at the end. Here is yet another experiment on acoustic model adaptation. This is using a lot less adaptation data. And this is even simpler. It's not doing any MLLR, no linear transformations. What you simply do is you go through that diagram that I showed you where you just retrain the recognizer. So there's no constraints anymore on how exactly you do it. And you can see that, again, you get very significant improvements from about 60% this is the test data is TI digits. What this means is connected digits. So imagine you're reading a credit card number over the phone. That's the type of data that we're looking at. And they have a lot of noise. It's exactly to measure how well we can deal with noise over the cell phone channel. And the initial models were very mismatched. They're Wall Street Journal type models, and they were built in very clean speech. It's recorded in the studio with a close talking microphone, and it's very different from using a cell phone. And initially, if you take the Wall Street Journal models and you test them on the TI digits data, you get about 60% accuracy, which is 40% error rate. Very high. especially since this is a very constrained task. You have a vocabulary that is 10 digits, right? It's very, very constrained. So the state of the art, you can see the last row in the table shows you the best possible performance. If you train on like data and so on, you can get up to 90-some% accuracy. So there's quite a lot of improvement to be had from doing adaptation. And here, Asela, he's a former colleague at Microsoft, he just retrains the recognizer starting from the Wall Street Journal acoustic models, and you can see how things get a lot better very quickly. After 4 iterations, he goes almost more than half the way there. And using the lattices helps. What that shows is that you don't need to making the hard decision that this is the one word hypothesis that my recognizer should use for adaptation actually hurts you a little bit. If you hedge your bets and say, well, I don't really know what has been said. I have those probabilities for different word sequences, and I'm going to try to deal with that, you do gain, and it's a significant gain. Let's see, how much is that? About 7% out of 40. That's, 15% relative or so. Pretty big. So that concludes the speech recognition part. And hopefully you have some understanding of how one goes about building a speech recognizer. I would say that the most important thing there is that it's a statistical algorithm. It's it's deterministic in the sense that if you feed the same waveform twice, you're going to get the same output. But there's a probability distribution around the result. You don't know for sure what the result ought to be. It's not strictly a function, as in, you know, in the mathematical sense. Here is the input, here is the output. We also have a probability distribution for what the output should be. So that's one point. The other point is, to represent that probability distribution, we can use lattices to encode in a compact way all that list of word sequences. And the third point to take home is, you can build very good speech recognizers as long as the test data is very similar to the training data that you used for both the acoustic model and the language model. And that's the state of the art in speech recognition. That's how people have been building speech recognizers so far. If you look at all the government evaluations in DARPA and so on, they always have, you know, millions of words that are just like the test data, and then the acoustic modeling training data is recording exactly in the conditions where that you're going to test them. So they do pretty well. You get down to 10-15% word error rates on tasks like Wall Street Journal, Switchboard, and broadcast news and so on. The trouble is that as soon as you move to a different task, the models break down very quickly. They're very brittle, and for example, I'm going to show you numbers later on, but for MIT data, if you take a state-of-the-art recognizer built for Wall Street Journal, which is newswire text, instead of getting 10% word error rate, you jump to 40-some, 45% word error rate. And the same happens if you were to start from a broadcast news state-of-the-art recognizer or from a Switchboard one, which is conversational speech over the telephone. So adaptation becomes a huge, huge problem. And that's what I tried to hint at in the last set of slides. So that's probably the conclusions that I would draw from the speech side. So now I want to move to the core of the presentation, which is retrieval, and in particular, retrieval for spoken documents. And again, before going to explain how we would do retrieval of spoken documents, I want to briefly review the text retrieval algorithms that we know about, because one simple way to solve this problem is to simply say, well, I'm going to take my speech recognizer, run it on the spoken documents, get the one best transcription, ignore all this probability business, no lattices, nothing like that. And I take that as text. And yeah, there's going to be errors. And maybe they're not going to hurt us too much. And I can just use a standard text retrieval algorithm to build my search engine. And that's exactly what the track evaluations did. And you remember yesterday I mentioned those at the beginning. And in the last part of the talk, I want to show that you can do significantly better if you want to integrate the text retrieval and the speech recognition much closer, and you can get significant improvements that way. So this is what I'm going to talk about, and we might be able to finish today. If not, there's going to be a shorter meeting tomorrow. We'll see how that goes. The last part is about user interface, which is very hard to talk in terms of, you know, algorithms and so on, because it's even more of an art than all this other stuff. Here, at least we can measure things. There, it's a lot more complicated. So, as a rule of thumb, don't think that, you know, this is the final word about spoken document retrieval. This is, in fact, far from it. It's an active area of research, and there's no established way of solving these problems as of yet. What I'm going to describe is, you know, some work I did recently, and at the same time I would like to balance that and present what other people have done, and hopefully it's going to look more like an overview that way. Yeah, don't think that, you know, this is the one way to do it, because that's not how things are. A bit of notation. Let's say that we have a collection of documents, D1 through DN, and this is what we're going to do search on. If you think of the World Wide Web, well, N is the number of pages on the web. If you think of the MIT iCampus lectures, well, it's about 300 or so spoken documents, each of them 1 hour long, and so on. If you want to search emails on your desktop, you're probably going to have less than 1,000, 10,000 of them. I would call that a small collection. If you look at anything above that, you get into large numbers, millions. You know, a book that you hold in your hand will have on the order of hundreds of pages, right? That's, again, relatively small search problem. So we're going to just label documents with D, capital D, 1 through N. And keep in mind that N can get pretty large. Queries, well, queries are a little different than the documents in that they are a sequence of words and they are ordered. You can make an assumption. Eugene mentioned this phrase yesterday, bag of words, which means that the order is irrelevant. But in fact, with queries, we know that it's not. And I'm going to have examples later on showing that it matters. So for a query, the order of the words matters. And we're going to label them 1 through capital Q going from left to right. That's simple vector notation. And there's going to be a large vocabulary in which the query words live. And how large it is, well, for the web problem, it's on the order of millions of entries. For other problems, like for spoken document retrieval, the vocabulary is simply going to be the vocabulary of the recognizer. You can't really recognize, unless you do something about the out-of-vocabulary words, you're not going to be able to query words that are not in the speech recognition vocabulary. So all this is geared towards the keyword search that we're all familiar with. You get a search box, you type some keywords in, and you get some documents back, right? But that's not the only way to search. I don't know if you remember Yahoo in the old days. They started building an ontology of all the web pages, and I think they may still have some of that on their website. Like, you can go and click on finance or on sports, and you get web pages in those areas, and then you sort of go down a tree to find pages that you might care about. So that's one way of doing it, where the ontology is built either supervised or unsupervised. Another way you could do it is collaborative filtering. You keep track of who watched what, and then as soon as you go to see a page, other people that saw that page will probably recommend you, well, you should also try these other pages. And it's the same idea as in the Amazon book recommendation system. I mentioned that yesterday. So that's actually very powerful. It's surprising how well that works. Then for the spoken document problem, you may try to do away with speech recognition altogether. Namely, say, well, you know, why don't I just say the query? And I have a waveform, which is my query. And then I have the spoken documents themselves, which are waveforms, and I try to do the matching in that space. Don't bother transcribing into words on both sides, and you know, we could try doing something like that. And that's a very good approach, because you don't have any sort of vocabulary issues at that point. I just don't know that it would work very well from the results that have been published yet. But again, people are trying to solve the problem that way. So just keep that in mind. So let's see. Probably the most popular, and the one that you saw in the demo yesterday, and the model that you're going to keep bumping into over and over in this space, is the so-called TF-IDF model. And TF-IDF is a shorthand for term frequency inverse document frequency. That's what the TF-IDF respectively stand for. It's very easy to explain how it works and how you would build such models. So remember how we had the list of documents D1 through DN and the vocabulary of words in which our query terms live, V. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to list on the row side, I'm going to list all the words in my vocabulary. And on the column side, I'm going to list all my documents in some order. The document order doesn't matter. And then I'm going to go over each document and count how many occurrences of each of the words in my vocabulary I have in that particular document. So I'm going to end up populating this matrix. And many of the entries will stay at zero, right? Because very few words happen in every document. Likewise, if you look at it the other way, a document contains just some set of words, and the other entries in that column have to be zero, right? But I can, based on that, I can calculate the so-called term frequency, which you see the first term there, Fij, and this... So it's this term here. So this is nothing but the normalized relative frequency. So I take the number of times I see a word, I, in document J, and divide by the total number of words in document J to get the relative frequency of that word in the document. And the reason I want to do this is because if I have a long document, It's you know, it just has 10,000 words. Well, you know, you don't want to just use the raw counts, because it would be unfair when you compare the document with one that has just 1,000 words. On the average, things will happen 10 times more in the 10,000 word document. So this normalization is important. So that's the TF part of the algorithm. Then. There's the second part is actually quite interesting. What it says that not all words are created equal when you look at search. The idea goes back to what we were discussing yesterday when we were playing with the demo. It's, you know, when you type a search query, you're never going to use function words. Pronouns, maybe, but they're not going to be very useful. So there's a set of words that don't help you discriminate very well. And the way to transcribe, how would you express that in some mathematical form? One simple intuition is that such a word happens in all the documents. And if it happens in all the documents, and more or less with the same frequency, then really it's not telling you much about any of those documents. If on the other hand, if you analyze the other limit case, right, instead of taking the word the, which is a function word, and you can guarantee that every document, almost every document, will contain the word the, if you go to the extreme and you take a funny word, I don't know, some unpronounceable disease, and there's going to be just a handful of documents that contain that word, right? And well, that's a very good query word in the sense that if that's what you're looking for, then that's the word you should be putting in your query, because you're going to get back just 5-10 documents, and you're going to look at those, and you're going to find the one you want to read, right? So to express that, you have this second term in the formula here, which is the inverse document frequency. And you can see there how we divide the total number of documents by the Ni. Ni is the number of documents in which word I happens, right? So if it's a word like the, Ni will be equal to capital N, and that logarithm will be logarithm of 1, 0. So that word actually has this TF-IDF weight, Tij, of 0, right? It's not a word that will help us in any way. If, on the other hand, this word happens in exactly one document out of the N, you all of a sudden have log of n in IDF, which will mean that the relative frequency of that word, however many times it happens in that document, gets boosted by log of n, where n is the number of documents, which is the highest it can get, really. So that's how TF-IDF engines are built. So now, remember, we were talking about the matrix of counts. Well, think of the matrix of counts helping you build this second matrix, which is the TIJ terms, the TF-IDF matrix. And again, it lists on the rows words, on the columns it lists documents, and each entry is that value there. And how are we going to use this to calculate a relevant score? Where? So if you give me a query, Q, we take, as you can see here, we take every single word in the query, WIQ, and then multiply that with the TF-IDF weight for word, the same word in document J, right? So the input to this function, SDJ of, and Q is the query, and one document. I take every single document in my collection, one by one. I go through all of them. And for every document, I calculate this term, S of DJ and Q, this number. And then I'm going to list the documents in decreasing order of this relevance score. That is the term that people use to describe this SDJQ quantity. So I'm going to list the documents in inverse order of the relevant score, and the more relevant ones are always at the top, right? And it's you just basically sum the TF-IDF scores for all the words in the query. There's some normalization involved there, and another tweak is that there's symmetry. I mean, you could also think of the document being a query and the query being a document, a very short one. So if you start doing the TF-IDF type adjustments on the document side, well, why not do it on the query side too? So that's what this formula here does. It basically builds a TF-IDF-like weight for each of the query words. Now, the problem is that if you have short queries, let's say that you have a query of exactly two words all the time, and then, you know, it matters which word appears in how many of the queries using the IDF formula. But if all the words are pretty rare, then, you know, you're basically going to see them more or less the same number of times there. So this is not going to help you much. And then for the relative frequency of the word in the query, it's going to be 1 out of 2. So this is going to be 0.5 here. So this whole thing ends up being some constant number. So I don't think it's very useful, and people end up using the bottom line, which is simply normalizing the TF-IDF scores on the document side. So a few comments. So are there any questions about the TF-IDF model? How many of you think you understood it? Okay, well, that's encouraging. How many of you have seen it before? Less, good. a few problems with it that I can identify, and you may identify even more. One problem, it's a hit or miss model. You're never going to get documents that are related but do not contain the query words. So let's say that you issue a query for Coca-Cola, right? And if you have a document that reads something like, its Coke brand is the most treasured asset of the soft drinks maker, blah, 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 right? So there's no Coca and there's no cola in this sentence, and clearly it's about Coca-Cola, right? You would like this document if you're interested in Coca-Cola. So this is somewhat of a problem. The point is, though, we are pretty good at writing queries. So I think this is not quite such a big issue. There are other more subtle problems with it. One of them is Coca-Cola is a very, very specific word sequence. Each of those two words in isolation mean a lot less than the phrase Coca-Cola. So when I enter Coca-Cola, I actually mean quote Coca-Cola unquote. In Google query language terms. I want exactly this phrase matched. I don't want cola coca, for example. Or I don't want coca, some word, cola, right? So TF-IDF has no way to do this in the ranking formula that I just showed you. Each word in the query is independent. There's that bag of words assumption. And what you need to do if you want to express this in TF-IDF terms, well, you need to basically do some sort of post-filtering. TF-IDF will not let you do this. So that is the shortcoming of the relevance ranking formula that we're using. You should never have hacks like this. I mean, you should be able to explain this in the way you do the relevance scoring there. So this is probably the most extreme problem of the third bullet here, namely, even if you don't put the quotes, TF-IDF will ignore the word order and the proximity. And here is an example. Let's say your query is object-oriented programming. And again, there's no quotes there. But we as humans, we clearly understand here that this query is about some type of programming that is called object-oriented, right? And object-oriented is a strong bigram by itself, and then you have the programming, attached to that entity. So if I see a document like the one in blue that says, the object-oriented paradigm makes programming a joy, that's clearly a document that is relevant to my query, right? Everybody here knows what I mean by object-oriented programming? Yeah, okay. If I look at the second line here, the one in red, TV network programming transforms the viewer in an object, and it is oriented towards selling stuff, okay? Well, I have all the words in the query. I have programming, I have object, I have oriented. TF-IDF type scoring will rank these two sentences equally. Right? I just have each of the query words happening there once. I do all that magic with the IDF numbers are going to be the same because they're the same words. So all that can differ is the term frequencies, and they're the same. And yet, it's obvious to anybody that for that particular query, I have absolutely no interest in the second line, and I have a lot of interest in the first line. So our relevance scoring is not capturing any of this. We're not doing things well there. And what we're missing out is exactly this word order and proximity issues. I don't want oriented object. That means something else. An oriented object is something that has been oriented in a given direction, right? I don't want to talk about programming that is, you know, TV type programming. Or I'm talking about computer programming, and I'm talking about object-oriented programming. And we understand that when we see that query, and we want to have a mechanism that allows us to rank documents taking that into account, right? And TF-IDF is not the one. Okay. So after bashing TF-IDF, let's move to another popular way of doing text retrieval. And this looks at the queries and at the documents as vectors. And you've seen already a little bit of that happening in TF-IDF. If you look at the columns in the TF-IDF matrix, that can be regarded as a vector of numbers, right? It's how many times each of the words in the vocabulary happened in that document. So that's a vector. And then I can also take my query and say, well, you know, I have a bunch of words in my query, and I can populate just a vector of that type, where I put 0 whenever I see a word, I don't see a word, and 1 when I see a word. And these vectors live in R to the V, where V is the vocabulary size. And I know how to compare vectors. Everybody here knows how to compare vectors? Show of hands. Really? No? Okay. So if I have a vector, 1, 2, 3, and another vector, 3, 2, 1, are they close or far away from each other? So one simple way to do it, right, is, so let's say that I have two vectors, right? And I have another vector. And they happen to be equal. And I have another vector, 3, 2, 1. So there's different ways of doing it. But essentially what you would like to see is, are they component-wise, are they, you know, close to each other? So here, for example, I will take, if I call this V1, this is V1, 1, this is V1, 2, this is V1, 3. If I call this V2, this is going to be V2, 1, V2, 2, V2, 3. And if I calculate V1i minus V2i squared sum over all the i's, I will get 0. Because I take 1 minus 1, 0, 2 minus 2, 0, 3 minus 3, 0, and this should be 0. They're the same, right? If I look at this other vector, well, 1 minus 3, that's minus 2 squared 4, plus 0 again, plus another 4, I get 8 here. Well, clearly, this is closer to V1 than this one, right? So you can do this type of calculations in various ways. They're called vector norms, and many of them turn out to be equivalent. But there's a lot of mathematics around this stuff. In linear algebra, you can find a lot about comparing vectors, vector norms, and so on. So what this would do, it would take the text retrieval problem and just cast it, you know, throw it in the arms of linear algebra and say, you know, we're just mapping everything to vectors, and from there on we're going to use established ways of dealing with them. And there's a lot of approaches to this. People start looking at, well, you know, if you start looking in these vector spaces, we can start enriching both the query and the document, as we had that Coca-Cola example. Well, you know, I know that Coke is in the same, lives in the same world with Coca-Cola, so I can add that word to the query, I can add it to the document. So instead of just comparing these vectors, I compare something that is more of a cone around each vector and so on. And these are, you know, document query expansion. In Trek, these were very popular. What happens is, do people here know precision and recall? This is important. How many people understand precision and recall? So I should take it that the other ones don't understand precision and recall? Who doesn't understand precision and recall? Okay, so it needs to be explained.
So
let's say I have a set of things, and I'm going to use four something, right? Four figures here, and this is my universe. So I live in a universe where I work with four objects. And I make sets out of these objects. And one set I can make is this one. Right? Or some kid comes to me and says, well, you know, I have this other object. It's going to look like this. Right? Or some kid comes to me and says, I have this other, or this is the star, whichever way I drew it, like this, right? So this is set one, this is set two, this is set three, right? Let's say that I want to know how close this set is to this other set, right? I have this question to answer. How could I do it, right? So one way to say is, well, you know, I clearly have all the objects here in this set exist in my reference set, right? I have both the triangle and the square, but I'm missing a few. So I could do better if I really wanted to get close to this one. Right? So on one hand, I the ones I have are good, but I'm missing a few. So the way we express that is, I have a precise answer. So let's say that I ask a question, and you know, the question has 10 alternative good answers, and you basically give me one of those answers. Well, you're very precise. You've given me one good answer, but there's a lot more there. So we say you have good precision, right? This is a very precise set in the sense that all the elements are contained in the set that we're measuring against, but I'm not getting all of them. And that's a recall problem, right? We're not recalling all that we should have. So that's probably a way to memorize this easily, but this set has precision. I count the number of common objects. For precision, P. And I divide by the total number of objects in my set, not the one I'm measuring against. And here it's you know. The reference, and let's call this, we call this the reference set. This is S1, right? So for us, this is going to be 1. So I have a very precise set, but I'm not getting two out of four, right? The original set contained four objects, and I'm missing these two guys. And that's exactly what recall measures. It says, out of the original four, I got two. So I will measure the number of common ones divided by the total number in reference. So you can see that the difference between precision and recall really is, what do I divide by? The numerator is the same, is the number of common objects, and the denominator is, in one case, is the number of objects that I have in my set that I'm looking at, and the number, in the other case, is the number of objects that I should have, which is what's in the reference, right? So, what is precision and recall here? Someone who said they didn't understand precision, or they didn't know about it, who would want to take a shot? So what would precision be here? 2 by 3. So that's because we have three elements here, and these two are the good ones, right? And then what would recall be? Two divided by four, right? And that's because out of the four ones that we wanted to get, we only got two, right? And how about this one here? All right, it should be easy, right? So basically, we got one. One out of two is good. And again, out of the four that we had there, we only matched one, right? So, but you can see how you can do very well on one, but do very poorly on the other, and vice versa. So you would like to balance these two. So people start measuring something called the F measure, which is one over P plus one over R, the harmonic mean of these two. And it basically says that, you know, we actually want to maximize both of these. In the perfect answer has precision equals 1 and recall equals 1. It's not either. It's both of them have to be 1. And you can see how, actually, this is 2 over, right? And the F measure becomes 1 in that case. Very often, you will see precision recall plots. You have an algorithm, and in this case, for retrieval, you have an algorithm that returns documents, right? And we can always plot a set of documents, D1, for a query. And I'm going to mark with X, you know, the relevant ones, right, from 1 through N. And then I have my retrieved list, and I will match some of these, but not all, right? And then I can go and calculate precision and recall there and say, well, how many of the documents I should have gotten I have, that's the recall. How many of the documents I got are actually relevant, and that's precision, right? So if you have a good search engine, you want one that maximizes both precision and recall. Ideally, you want to get all the documents and only the correct ones. And the way to express that is, you know, precision and recall one. But that doesn't always happen, right? So if I am to plot on two axes, precision and recall, and it really doesn't matter which is where. As we were saying, the best case scenario is being up here in this corner. Each of them is less than one because the number of common objects cannot be greater than either the number of objects in my set or in the reference set, right? So I'm always going to be somewhere inside this square, and I want to be as close as possible to this corner. And algorithms, more often than not, they may have some parameters there. And as you play with those parameters, you move somewhere in this square, right? So you will see curves of the type, whenever I change I don't know what, I change my precision and recall trade-off, right? I have an algorithm that is very precise, but it really returns just one document all the time. And it's the right one all the time. But then that's not such a good search algorithm. You're going to be somewhere here. You have good precision, very poor recall. If you have something that returns all the documents all the time, well, that's sort of a search algorithm too. You just, whenever you get a query, you just return everything, right? And that's going to have perfect recall. It gets all of the correct documents, but it has really lousy precision. Probably not all of them are relevant to your query. Otherwise, you wouldn't bother, right, querying. So whenever you do that, you're somewhere here. So those are the extreme cases here. And you most often, you want to be at an operating point that is on the diagonal here. That's the equal precision and recall point, right, on this line. Precision and recall are equal. So if you can tune things such that you're in this point, it's a good place to be. So coming back to this, I was mentioning how doing query and document expansion, now you understand that will always increase recall because you just increase the number of things that get matched. So the number of common things can only go up. And if the number of common things goes up, and I'm dividing by the total number in the reference, so recall always goes up, but precision likely will go down. It's not guaranteed. If you manage to do this without getting hurt in precision, you're going to gain. Right? So.
Should we mention that from the user's perspective, the precision is more important?
Well, I don't know. It's not a given thing. It depends. It depends on how exactly you do the search. If you're looking for one specific document and you're not returning it, then you may be precise, but it's still not the one you want. Well, if you search for a restaurant and you enter McDonald's, right, and you enter McDonald's and you get a web page about some family in Scotland called McDonald's, you know, it's a relevant document. Well, why?
I'm searching for a restaurant.
Who says so? McDonald's doesn't say that it's a restaurant. You know that in your head. I mean, if you say McDonald's restaurants, then it's a different story, right? Things are a little ambiguous there. But if there's exactly one document and you're not getting it, yeah, I guess you're right. Then you can have precision, but then that's it. It's both recall and precision are one. I don't know if that, people always seem to think that, yeah, precision is more important. And in the case of web search, you in fact cannot even measure recall. And many search problems are like that, where people come and say, well, you know, it does really well, but they never measure recall. I mean, you have no idea how much you're missing. You type McDonald's, and if there is more than one in Prague, and there's one really close to you, and the search engine sends you to the other end of the city, well, you know, is that a good thing? Probably not, but you would never know, because you didn't know that this other restaurant was here next to you. Because you can't measure it. So that's one problem with, you know, all web search engines, you know. They all say, well, I'm better than the other one, but you really don't know what's there.
So when you tune your system, you look at DF measure as a combination of the two?
We're going to get to that. But people in the Trek community have been using something called mean average precision. And what you do is I'm going to have a slide on that, but you start drawing these precision recall curves for every query, and then you start measuring the area underneath the query, which is showing how close you are to the upper right corner, and that's one average, and then you average over all queries. So that's why you have mean average precision. But I'm going to have a nice drawing saying just that. So coming back to vector space models, this idea of query and document expansion, you can express it mathematically in a nice way by doing one of these projection methods. And I'm not going to insist here. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time. The idea is that these vectors that we're talking about here, they live in very high dimensional spaces. The vocabularies can be millions of words or, you know, hundreds of thousands. These are really big vectors. And many of the entries are zero, right? And it makes makes those comparisons, you know, L2 norm calculations, what we did, very hard, because you're really looking at the entries that match. And that's what also happens in the TF-IDF case, if you think about it that way. And those are very few, and basically the similarity measures that you're getting are very noisy here. So what people said, well, could we map this into some lower dimensional spaces where we can measure the differences between vectors more accurately? And that's what's at the core of all these different methods that are mentioned here. And they take the term document co-occurrence matrix, TF-IDF or something like that, and map it to a lower dimensional space. And in that space, you can then compare vectors, just like you did in the upper space, only you do it more accurately because they have smaller dimensions. And there are different ways of doing that dimensionality reduction. Again, this is a paraphernalia that comes from the linear algebra world, and I'm not very familiar with all those, and I don't think we should spend a whole lot of time there. But the main point here is that, you know, you're still ignoring word order. You have a bag of words assumption in all these vector methods. And probably more importantly, this is a very simple and intuitive point. It's you are losing control over the search engine, right? There's this magic thing happening there. There's the projection onto lower dimensional, and things get compared in a way that is very, very non-intuitive to you. So that will impair your ability to control what you're getting out of the search engine. We are very good at language. We're extremely good at language. No algorithm has come even close to what a human can do with language. So the way this goes, I type a query, I see what documents I get back, I look at them, and I say, well, I want more like those and less like the other ones. And I see what exactly was wrong with my query. Why did I get those other documents that I didn't want? And I correct my query. I either add some words, I refine it. And you know, in a few iterations like that, I pretty much nail it down. But that's because I know exactly what's going on. I get documents that match my keywords. Now assume that you live in a world where you don't know exactly what documents you get back. You type in a query, and all of a sudden comes a document to you which contains none of the words in your query. Just like Coca-Cola there, right? I mean, you know, it so happened that I showed the good document, but you're going to get a lot of documents that have nothing to do with Coke whatsoever. So why are these here? Well, I don't know. How am I going to change my query to get rid of them? Again, I don't really know because I'm doing all this fancy stuff. So my personal take on all this is I don't think it's a good idea. But, you know, I must underline the fact that it's just my own opinion here. Another family of algorithms. So we've gone over TF-IDF. They belong to the vector space models. And this is a radically different look at the search problem. And here, what you say is, OK, let's assume that we have a probability model over documents and queries. It's a joint probability model, P of D and Q. And I want to rank documents. And one good way of doing it, how many people here know about mutual information between random variables? Good. Okay. So for those, how many people don't know about mutual information? Oh, so I see. The other ones are just neutral. So when you have two random variables, so let's say that there's one random variable that says weather, and it can take two values, good and bad, and there's another random variable that says season, and it can take four values. It's winter, fall, spring, and summer, right? You would like to know, do these random variables have anything to do with each other or not? Does it matter at all to the weather what season I'm in? Or the other way around, knowing the weather, can I sort of call a season and how well, right? So that's what mutual information is trying to measure. And you can sense that, the weather and the seasons are somewhat related. And if in a more extreme example, if you have two random variables that are a function of each other, for example, if one of our random variables was, instead of season, now we have season, and the other random variable is month of the year. Well, if you're in the northern hemisphere, it's pretty clear when spring ends and summer starts, and so on. So you just know exactly if it's summer. Well, I have to be in one of these months, or rather the other way around. If I'm in August, well, it's summer, right? So then these two random variables are a function of each other. The mutual information between them is the highest it can be. From one, you can tell the other, right? The other extreme case is when they have nothing to do with each other. And you measure, what is the weather good or bad? And also you measure the age of the average age of people in this class here, right? Clearly there's no reason to assume that there's any correlation between these two. The mutual information between these two random variables is going to be zero. And if you go through the mathematics of it, mutual information ends up being a sum of this type. And if the two variables are independent, like height in this class and weather, the joint probability of these two random variables will be the product of those two. Is that a common, are people here familiar with that? Independent events, probabilities of independent events, yeah? Okay, so.
I don't remember the logarithm in this formula. So is it there, or is it there for some other reason?
You mean?
So this formula looks familiar, but I'm not sure there was a logarithm.
If it was mutual information, there has to be a logarithm.
Oh, okay, maybe.
In fact, the definition of mutual information, strictly speaking, is not that. If you take the mutual information between two random variables, x and y, you have to list all the possible values for those. So it's going to be a sum over all the possible values for x, all the possible values for y, and you have p of x and y divided by p of x times p of y. And it really measures . So these are capital X and Y to denote random variables. The small X and small Y denote values that those random variables will take. Like, for example, weather is a random variable, good is a value for that random variable, bad is also a value for that random variable. Mutual information operates on random variables. It does not operate on values of random variables. It just measures, if those two random variables are independent, the probability of x and y is always the probability of x times the probability of y for all possible values of x and y. So then you will always get one here, so the mutual information is zero. At the other extreme, if one of them is a function of the other, x is a function of y, for example, then you can write the numerator as being p of x given y times p of y, and then here you have p of x times p of y, right? But if p of x is a function of y, these guys go away. They have to agree. It's always the same. So you have the highest possible mutual information here. I can't explain it. It's not obvious from this. But if you go back to, there's a formula in terms of entropies. And if x is a function of y, the entropy of x given y is zero, because there's no uncertainty about the value of x knowing y. So then that's the maximum value for the mutual information there. Anyhow, this is getting way too detailed. Does this answer your question for why the logarithm is there? I mean, in many ways, that's a very deep question. Why the logarithm for measuring entropies and mutual information? No, it's actually a very interesting problem. And how exactly, I mean, why not some other function, right? And the short answer comes from pretty much this. It's independence. And the logarithm, if you have two independent events, the information in the joint space, I mean, it has to be the sum of one plus the sum of the other, because they don't have anything in common. So it pretty much gets to the bottom of it. When you start looking at information theory, this is one of the axioms that you need there to bump into logarithm. And you can come up with the logarithm from this. It's a very interesting question, in fact. Okay. So any other questions? Well, anyhow, so you can see how the mutual information, now that we've talked about it, would be a good way to go about this. Only the problem is here is I can't really measure the mutual information of instances of these two random variables, because what I really care about is here is a document. It's not a random variable. It's this value for the random variable. And then here's a query. Again, I have a value for it. And I would like to somehow get at this type of mutual information type relationship between them. So I take the inner term of that sum. And the justification is pretty much the same. If these two things have nothing to do with each other, then that probability will be the product of the two, and the mutual information will be zero. If they're, you know, in tight correlation, then the mutual information will be the highest possible. Mutual information is always positive. That's one thing you should remember. So here we can write things this way, using the chain rule. Here we can write p of q given dj times p of dj, and we're left with the query term doesn't depend on the document at all, right? So here we have the probability of the query given some document, J. And we can use that as our relevance scoring function. It's actually very easy, right? So for assuming that we had this probability, for every document, I go and calculate the probability of the query given that document. And I rank my documents in that order. And I'm just going to say, well, here is my most relevant document. And I go down that list to find the less relevant documents. And a simple way to do this is, of course, nobody gives you that probability model. But you can build it. You can we know how to build n-gram models by now. So you take a given document, and you build an n-gram model from it. And then when the query comes, you say, OK, what's the probability of the query under this language model that I've built? And you calculate exactly that, P of Q given DJ. And you use that to rank documents. And it works quite well. The only problem is, well, it takes a lot to store, because you need to store a language model for each document. And if you use n-grams, you basically store each word n times, because the n-gram window slides over that word n times, right? So you've stored a lot more than the original document. It's expensive to store, but on the other hand, it takes word order into account, because the n-grams already have word order in them, which is what makes it work so well. And finally, this is what Google was doing at the time they went into business. And I don't know exactly what happens there now. But this is a very interesting algorithm. It basically says, you know, I'm not going to bother with this sort of principled approaches. We know what's important when we do ranking. We want to take into account proximity of words in the query. We want to be able to put that into our scoring function. We want to put into the scoring function the relative frequency of query words in my document. How often do they happen in that document? Very important. And ideally, I would also want to take into account the context in which a given word happens. So if I have a query word that happens in the title of a web page, well, I would say that it's more important than if that query word happens somewhere at the bottom of the document, right? Not even in the first paragraph. Also, if it happens in big font as opposed to really small font, then, you know, probably the guy who wrote that page wants to communicate something there. The big font is there because it's more important somehow. So you can see how there's this idea of what is the context in which the word happens. So they decided to use this type of features to build a search engine, right? And we operate now with a concept called a hit. And this is going to be important for the rest of the presentation. And by a hit, we mean the occurrence, the exact occurrence of one of the query words in a document, right? So a hit operates on documents, and it tells us for a given query word where exactly and in what context that word happened in that document, right? So if you want to measure proximity, your hits should somehow store the position in the document at which the word happens. So if I take my document and I basically arrange the words to go from left to right, and you know, I have first the title, then the first paragraph, and second paragraph, and so on, then I can list exactly at what position a given word happened in my document. And the hit will contain the integer position there. If I also know the context, well, here is where the title started, and here is where it ended, and you know, different other font level information, and so on, I can encode that in my hit. And that way, I can build this equivalent representation of the document as far as the relevant scoring is concerned. And I don't store the full document. I don't build one of those fancy vectors that I built before. I have this simple list of hits. For every word in the document, I list the position at which it happened and in what kind of context. Was it in the title and so on? And then I'm going to build my relevance score using this type of information. And it's important to notice that I don't need to go back to the original document to calculate relevance scores. I can just use the hit list to do that. And I'm going to do a linear combination of counts of words in the query, bind by type. And when I say type, I will mean proximity types. For example, when we had object-oriented programming, where was that? Here, right? So if for this query, I will look at object-oriented. Well, that's a proximity type. I have the query, the first two query words next to each other, right? So I will say, well, that's more valuable than the object and the oriented when they happen separate from each other. TF-IDF was unable to take that into account. So I'm going to have a feature that's going to say, yeah, object happened, oriented happened, but also object-oriented happened. And I'm going to have a weight for that. And the weight for that, in fact, is going to be quite high because I like the fact that when words happen next to each other coming from my query. So those are the proximity types. And then I also can start using the context. So if a certain word happens in the title, well, I can weight that higher, right? So I can start creating all these feature vectors and multiply each feature with a vector, pretty much, you know, these log linear models that Eugene Charniak was talking about for parsing and so on. You can think of this problem in that framework where you have a feature vector and the features are proximity-based features or context-based features, and you have weights for them. And your scoring function is going to be just the product of weights times the features that actually trigger. This pretty much puts in all our intuition about what is important when we do ranking, but, you know, we don't really have a way to estimate those weights. We can start guessing at them to get good results, and that's a little ad hoc. But that's pretty much what Google was doing when they started. And they had another feature that was very important, which is the famous PageRank. And it had to do with links from one page to another. And I could explain that one too, but it's not so relevant here. So a final point about text indexing is that if you want to be able to do search in very large collections of documents, you need some way of building an inverted index. And this is the same point that the index at the back of a book is about. Think about trying to find all the occurrences of a given word in a book. It's a pretty bad, you know, it's a hard problem. You're going to have to go through every single page in the book and quickly scan it to find where did that word occur. And it may take you a while. If it's a big book, it's going to be a bit of your time. Luckily, the guys who publish books figured out that, you know, this might come in handy, especially if they're textbooks or, you know, they're not novels, anything that you may want to browse. So they build this index at the end of the book, right? So whenever you look for a certain word, you go to the back of the book, and then there's a list of pages where that word occurs, right? Well, that's not that different from the hits that we're talking about here. In fact, it's the same. So I list, for every word, I list the occurrence of that word on some page in my document, in my book, and I sort them such that it's going to be easy for you. But that's a very, very important algorithmic point here. It's the idea of an inverted index. That way, I can find things very, very fast. I don't need to go page by page through my book whenever I look for a word. I just go to the back of the book, I look up the pages where that word happens, done. If I have three words in my query, object-oriented programming, and I want to know, well, is there any page where object-oriented happened on the same page? Well, I go and take the list of pages on which object happened, and then I take the list on which oriented happened, and I just intersect those two lists, and I go to that page, and I'm done. If you wanted to do this on the old way without the index, well, it would take you a while, right? So this is probably one of the most important points here. Whenever you want to scale up to large collections of documents, and for speech, this is particularly important, because if you want to work with lattices, things are going to those pages get quite bushy. You want to build some sort of inverted indexing solution. And all these methods that we talked about do allow for inverted indexing. All the vector space methods, DFIDF, that matrix that we talked about, that's exactly the inverted index. It depends how you read it. If you look on the columns, you have the pages in your book. If you look on the rows, you have the index at the back of the book. What pages did each word happen? The language model is a little more complicated. There you need to store n-grams, and it's very expensive. As I said, if you have a word, the n-gram window will step 3 times over that particular word. So, or 4 times, depending whether you use a trigram or a four-gram. And Google, again, they built this, of course, with the inverted index in mind. And there, the hit will have to store the document ID or the page number. Then at what position on the page it happens, because I'm going to be interested in being able to tell, is object next to oriented or not, or how far it is from oriented. Is it 2 words or 3 words away from oriented? And then maybe some other context information. Is it in the title? Is it in, and so on. And we're running out of time here, right? I only had till 4. But I want to conclude with this slide, which is the evaluation. So how would you evaluate the search engine? And there's a package. You can download it from the web. It's called Trek Eval. And it's available on the NIST webpage, or it's replicated in many other places. You can just search for Trek_eval, and it will provide a bunch of scoring routines. And what it does is it assumes, it goes back to the precision recall issue. So if this is the list of documents in our collection, and I only list the ones that are relevant to a given query, right? So here is problem number one. You need someone, humans, to sit down, and for every single query in your test set, you want them to go through all the documents in your collection and tell you which is relevant and which is not to that particular query. This is a very hard problem. If you're looking at large collections of documents, and each document has some significant number of words, it's virtually impossible to do a good job here. And the other thing is, it's not clear what's relevant and what's not. Relevance from a human point of view differs. We can argue a lot about, McDonald's. What is a relevant page to that query? So you need this whenever you do this Trek-style evaluations. And then what you do is, well, here is the output from my search engine, right? And it's ordered. These documents are not ordered as far as the Trek scoring tools are concerned. And I can measure the following things. Well, I can measure precision and recall, just as we did, for the whole list of documents that I return. Or I can measure precision at the top 10 or 10 or 20 or 15 or so. So that's called precision at n. And basically what I do, I restrict the set to the top some documents, top 10 or top 15, and I measure precision among those. Or the most commonly used is what's called mean average precision. And there, I draw, for a given query, I go and draw this precision recall curve. And the way I do it, I start going down my list. And every time I hit 10, 20, 30, and so on percent recall, I put a point in the precision space, right? So I go down the list, and let's say that I had 10 relevant documents here in my reference list. And as I go down the list of results, I see the first relevant document. Bingo. I go and measure precision at that particular point, and I plot I put a dot here. So let's say it was 0.85 or something. And then I go further down, and I will recall can only go up, right? As I keep going down this list, because I can only see more relevant documents. So the first time I see the second document that is relevant, I stop and calculate precision there, right? So this curve will go down. So precision will have to go down, and so on and so on. And at some point, I hit the end of the list, and I'm done, right? So I have a precision recall curve of this type for a given query. And ideally, if I had a perfect search engine, every single result here would be relevant, one of these relevant documents. So The 10% point is the first one, the 20% point is the second one, and so on. So I never spend time looking at documents that are not relevant. So this line would be horizontal here. Basically, my precision is always one for all the recall bins. And I'm going to start measuring the area underneath. The area underneath the curve is going to tell me how well I'm doing compared to that ideal scenario, right? Anyhow, so I think I just messed this up. So we want the area under the curve to be as close to one as possible for every single query, right? So I'm going to measure the area under the curve, that's the average, in precision, and then I'm going to take the mean of that over all the queries. And that should be as close to one as possible. And the higher, the better, right? That is basically mean average precision. And one key point about the mean average precision is that it ignores the ranking on the reference side. On the reference side, the answers, the documents are all equal. They're either irrelevant or relevant, but there's no in-betweens. There's no ordering between them. And that's not so true. In practice, some documents can be more relevant than others. And for us, it's going to hurt us because when we evaluate spoken documents the way I did it in my experiments, I actually took the result on text, and there the reference list is ordered. Okay, so this is a good time to stop. Sorry for being over time, but I took probably more time to explain other stuff. So if there are any questions, we can do that now, or we can do it tomorrow.
I have a question. You said that the vector space model ignores the word order, which is
right.
True. But one way how to solve it is to enrich the vocabulary. You can add bigrams and trigrams to
right.
your vocabulary. Can you say a word about it?
Well, yeah, that's the probability model, the n-gram model. That's exactly what you're doing. You take n-grams, and you index n-grams, as opposed to.
Well, but the probabilistic model needs smoothing and other stuff, right?
Well, it would be nice to have it in the other case too. You don't have to do smoothing in the probability model. You can use the relative frequencies if you want.
Right.
I shouldn't say it's that model, but definitely they're very similar. You can come up, I'm sure for every n-gram indexing scheme, you can come up with an equivalent probability model and the other way around.
I was wondering whether people use it. It explode your dimension, dimensionality of the vector space, which is
right. Yeah. So that matrix, like right now, you were indexing words. So the number of rows in the matrix was the vocabulary size.
Right.
As soon as you go to n-grams, the number of rows is the n-grams, and that can be much much higher.
Okay. How about adding some significant multi-word expressions or something like that?
Sure. Yeah.
Well, I'm not asking whether it's possible, but whether do you know some results on this?
Do I know results? No.
Okay.
But I'm sure there is plenty of. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm willing to bet that somebody's done it. And you can find something on that.
That's sure. The direction you want to go.
No, that's very close to the direction I'm going in. I'm actually trying to see how I can use the Google type search for spoken documents. And rather than index, the thing is that you can what n-grams give you is position information, proximity features, and you can get that with the other type of indexing that stores the position along with the word. And that's a much more compact representation. If you think about the index size, it's much smaller. And you have exactly the same amount of information there. You can, because you can, from an index like that one, you can, I can compute all the n-grams that, that you might want to have. So it has exactly the same amount of information, only that it's smaller.